Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 23rd of April. A delight to be in your presence. Thank you very much to all of you for tuning in this morning. We are very happy that you do so. And if you're listening to us later on podcast, thank you for doing that as well. It is always nice to have you listening to what we present. This morning, we have a lot to talk about. We have a wonderful group to do it, and we will get started. We welcome your participation, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you, panel at WAMC.org. Let's get started. We'll welcome our group this morning, and we go to Dr. Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm doing good. Did you know that John Garfield died when he was 39 years old?
39.
That's 39.
Very young man.
Great actor.
How did you find that out? Was that just a...
I was looking up people who had lived on Fire Island.
there we go. And he lived there, I assume.
And he died because he had been called before his friend said he was very upset about him being called before the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Oh God! Well, that's
tragic. My thought for the morning. That's my thought for the morning.
Well, very upbeat. Thank you. That's good. let's go to former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics. She was our guest yesterday. She's our guest today, and we're thrilled. Judith Eng, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Happy day after Earth Day. I'm pooped.
Yeah, I bet.
It was a great day, and that panel with Elizabeth Colbert and Jeff Goodall is just wonderful. Joe, you did such a good job with that interview, and I hope we can keep it as an Earth Day tradition
in
the future.
Well, I certainly hope so, and thanks to all for participating. It was really it was very strong and a really good conversation with all of you. We also welcome back his second time this week, Albany County District Attorney David Soares. He was with us on our Derek Chauvin show on Wednesday. David, good morning. How are you?
Joe, good morning back at you. As far as how I am, I'm a bit nervous this morning. I'm in between Judith Eng and Rosemary Armijo, which is the proverbial rock in a hard place. So I need to be on my best behavior today.
You are a lucky man.
Yeah, you are a lucky man. You're absolutely right.
I am a lucky man. Alan and I, we need to watch ourselves carefully today.
You better believe it.
Just today.
Investigative reporter and New Albany journalism professor Rosemary I forgot to say our name. Rosemary Armijo is here. Hey, what's new?
Not too much. Happy to be back. I was a little out of the loop for a while. So.
Quiet week.
But Fire Island. The first shot's been fired already. This is cool.
Well, we're delighted you're here as always. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armijo, Judith Eng, and David Soares making up the panel. And again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's start talking about what is happening in the news today. And we do so with the following stories here. And I you can always tell when I pause, because that's me trying to actually open my email. So give me 2 seconds here and I'll be there. We go. I got it. We want to talk a little bit. Well, Judith, let's start here and talk about when we were having our Earth Day show yesterday. It was as the global climate summit was going on. A lot happened after we got off the air. So the reporting on this, the Washington Post has a few virtual hiccups, abundant mm-hmm. global relief as Biden puts the U.S. back in the game of climate efforts. So now that it has been completed, what do you think of what occurred yesterday?
Well, I think it was very significant and so linked to the future of the world as we know it. I mean, you know, there are these global summits and White House meetings quite regularly, and sometimes they're a dog and pony show, and, you know, they're nice. You show up, great speeches are made. They always have good snacks at the White House. But this is different. This feels so different. This is a turning point. the United States lost tremendous credibility on the world stage with Trump's positions on climate change. And as we talked about yesterday, you know, over the last 25 years, not enough leadership from the United States, nothing as bad as the last 4 years. But I think the president and the vice president are very serious about this. The global meeting continues today. It's a two-day summit. And in my experience, it's always day two that matters the most. You know, day one is aspirational speeches. The cameras are rolling. People are pretty jazzed up just about, you know, being able to participate with 40 world leaders. Today, they roll up their sleeves. They try to get commitments from the business community. And in fact, it's after today that really, really matters. So I'm going to just give myself a week of hope and optimism. I cannot express strongly enough how important it is that John Kerry is personally traveling the globe to really get high level engagement. And this comes just in the nick of time. You know, we wasted the last 4 years, as I've said repeatedly, carbon released into the air today lasts for decades. It's not like you can just turn the switch overnight. And there's a huge amount of work that people can do at the local and the state level. We need to keep the pressure up. Biden is going to be under bone-crushing pressure from the fossil fuel industry, from the chemical industry. They now view, you know, people may wonder, why have I rearranged my whole life to work on plastic pollution? It's because plastics is the plan B of the fossil fuel industry. They see their market declining for electricity generation and transportation. So they've shifted to using a byproduct of hydrofracking to now make plastics. And they're trying to build multi-billion dollar plastic manufacturing facilities, mostly in Texas, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and a few other states. And so we've got to stay ahead of this. The president, you know, understands that it's the emissions from transportation and power generation that is a major threat today. But he and his team need to look ahead to what the future threats are. And, you know, the details really matter. But I think yesterday was just a very significant day for the whole world. And we just need to make sure that those commitments, such as slashing greenhouse gas emissions by 50%, we have to make sure it happens.
Rosemary, what do you think?
It's hard to follow Judith on that. She's the expert. I think that there was a palpable sigh of relief from all of the allies that America appears to be back and is again a leader in getting a change on climate. However, there was also a little bit of nervousness in several speeches about whether we're reliable anymore. And the truth is, we don't know the answer to that. We don't know where we'll be in 2 years at elections. We don't know where we'll be in 4 years. And the world depends on something more than that. So the only way to assure it in the United States, I think, is with the kind of plan that Biden is pushing for green jobs. I guess that's the push they're going to try to get his infrastructure program through, build green infrastructure, and that means lots of jobs. And that will make people happy. The economy is booming right now, and that means you'll get more Democratic votes and more of a chance that the Biden administration will continue, which is urgently needed.
David.
Yeah, I don't think that our domestic politics have ever been as important, you know, globally as it is right now. All of our allies, and even in some that are not our allies, are going to be watching our domestic politics to see, you know, what happens over the course of the next several years. Because in 4 years, we laid to waste 75 years of diplomacy, you know, soft diplomacy, hard diplomacy. And while there was a palpable sigh of relief, as Judith and Rosemary stated, that America was back on that stage, America's back on that stage, you know, and there's tremendous insecurities that our allies are feeling right now because they don't know what's going to happen. And as Rosemary has just said, our domestic bill right now for infrastructure is more crucial because I think if it were to pass, it would send a stronger message to our allies that this is a serious commitment and one that will not be torn to shreds with a change of administration. So there's a lot that remains in the balance, you know, as we move and begin to have more discussions and reintroduce ourselves to the world as a leader in environmental science.
Alan, so...
Domestic politics in all of this is incredibly important. We're facing by-elections in 2022, and if it all goes Republican, which it may, I don't want to be a predictor of doom, but it may. That sometimes happens when a president of the United States is of the other party, and we know Donald Trump is sitting there and telling people, "Don't let them pull what I have accomplished." In other words, the terrible work that he did, and the terrible utterances that he made, and the terrible changes he made on climate change, and he is saying to those spineless creatures in the Republican Party, and particularly in the Senate, "Don't move, or I'll come after you." So we can't forget that this is going on in the background while we're giving credit to Biden, and he certainly deserves it for everything that he's doing.
Judith?
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely true. There is a lot that can be done with executive authority. For instance, the President Biden signed an executive order stopping new oil and gas leases on federal land, and an executive order setting up a civilian climate corps. The second one will need a budget appropriation. The first one they can do administratively. So, you know, you look at what you can do with your executive authorities, but to really make progress, you do need congressional cooperation. The infrastructure proposal that the president has made is very green and really focuses a lot on job creation from renewable energy. He has advanced a very interesting plan to put workers back to work who are currently working in the fossil fuel industry. Okay, you keep your job, but it's plugging up all of these abandoned oil and gas wells that are all dotting the whole country. I think their approach on, it's not just job retraining. I mean, I loved working in the Obama administration, but we screwed this up. You know, we were pushing an aggressive climate change agenda, and then like the Department of Labor was going to do job training workshops in West Virginia. That's not going to cut it. People need to transition to clean energy jobs, or the equivalent, that pay the same, that provide health benefits. And by the way, doesn't give you black lung disease by working in the mines. That's a big plus. So, you know, I think the Biden approach is very politically doable. We'll talk about David's friend Joe Manchin, and can one man in the Senate, you know, hold the fate of the world in his hands? But I think Biden is very shrewd, and he recognizes that for the congressional piece, he may only have 2 years. So that's why they are really, really pushing hard. In the Obama administration, the most aggressive push was in the second term. It politically makes a difference when you hit this right out of the gate, literally, you know, the first 4 months of your presidency. So I think their calculation, Alan, is they only have 2 years to really do the
big
stuff
right
on climate change.
Yeah, you're probably right. You know, Judith, I think often of the kind of here was Trump talking about a rigged game. You know, you can't rig it any more than when you gerrymander so that only your people can get elected. And in many of the red states, that's exactly what is going on right now. So we can expect pretty much that we're going to find this kind of machination happening in this country. And because he yelled rigged, 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 doesn't mean we shouldn't turn around, you know, and well, let's see, spit in his eye.
Go ahead.
Well, we only have a minute, so Judith and then Rosemary, but go ahead.
Well, I think the great irony, and I don't wish this on him, is when Mar-a-Lago is damaged by the next high energy hurricane that you can attribute to climate change. Florida is so vulnerable, and that's where he is. He has his base.
Ensconced.
There will be, I don't know, there's, you know, there'll be some ramifications for that. Karma is a you know what.
Yep. Rosemary, we have about 45 seconds. Go ahead.
No, I need more than 45 seconds. I'll wait till you come back, Joe.
All right, but now what am I supposed to do for that 45 seconds, Rosemary? Okay.
Let's all sing a song.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I can start. I think that Republicans actually gave an opening to Biden. They came back with a proposal that is one quarter of his, and it's strictly old-fashioned, fix the bridges and roads. I don't like it, but Biden does not have the power to do anything else. He cannot get rid of the filibuster. He's not going to get around Joe Manchin. So he has an opportunity here to start it. I think this has to go in phases.
Right.
Do the roads and bridges. They're a mess. And then I'll come back with the other rest of my
later. We'll do that.
Bye.
We'll be right back after this. Jim Steinman, who wrote all the songs on the Bat Outta Hell album, was Meatloaf's 1977 debut album and remains one of the most successful records of all time. He died on Monday in Danbury, Connecticut. He was 73 years old, so we'll be playing music from that this morning from both Bat Outta Hell and Total Eclipse of the Heart, which we'll play later on. Incredible music. So if you wonder why you're hearing the music of Mr. Loaf this morning, that is why. Good morning, everybody.
Well, it was actually Rosemary's theme song.
Nice. Very nice.
I'm laughing.
Oh, good. Well, thank God.
I'm the one who's...
Yeah, I know.
Was not Rosemary. That was me.
Thank you all. welcome back to the roundtable. We've got a great group. We got a lot of issues to get to. So, but Rosemary, I did have to cut you off for the make way for British people.
Yeah.
So please tell me what else was on your mind.
Well, what I wanted to say was that Biden does not have the power, as I see it, to get through his whole package. He just does not have the votes. He doesn't have the votes within the Democratic Party. So if he talks to Republicans, he gets to say, oh, see how bipartisan I am. He gets through step one, which are roads and bridges. No one disagrees on that. And then he begins preparing the country for the kind of thinking that made Eisenhower one of our greatest presidents. It's that infrastructure is planning for the future, and that's an electrical grid. It's all the other sorts of green programs in there that Republicans right now are rejecting. But he can get further along, and he can get some of this pushed through before 2 years, the midterms, when he's going to face. Then you see. After that, he might have more votes. I also am disappointed that he has connected the social programs. I see the point. I know that they are connected to infrastructure and doing better, but it just seems to add a whole nother political complication to getting through an infrastructure bill. That can be handled separately, could it not?
I agree with Rosemary. This infrastructure bill has the potential to really redefine domestic politics in his first, you know, the first half of his term, which I think if he were to be successful there, then this could really be the one of the few times that the party of the president is more successful in the midterm of that president than we've ever seen before. A lot of it, you know, hinges on his ability to get people like Manchin on board. And right now, I think if all goes according to what I believe is his plan, you know, we should see more projects heading in the direction of West Virginia. You know, it's just going back to what we know is old sound politics, where you take a lot of pork barrel spending, you put lipstick on that pig, and you send it over to West Virginia, and maybe there's some pressure on Manchin to go along with Biden. But I don't think that Biden can afford to come too much off of what the total price tag and ask of his bill. This bill that's being introduced by the Republicans is just absurd, because infrastructure isn't simply roads and bridges anymore. It is, as Rosemary and it is, as Judith has said, it has infrastructure must be built in with an eye towards the future and the environment.
Judith.
Yeah, you can't just do roads and bridges. I mean, I understand the political reality of that, Rosemary, but they'll never get to the other stuff if you just do that. And also from a climate change perspective, we don't want more roads and expanded highways and not a commensurate investment in mass transit and walkable and bikeable communities, et cetera. I think Biden knows exactly
Yep. Trump didn't even get roads and bridges through. Trump did not even get roads
and
bridges through.
Well, he didn't try. You know, how many times did they do Infrastructure Week? But I think Biden is Biden's going to succeed
here. Well, we can
blame
Trump, but let's talk about people. We do need roads and bridges. I mean, aside from climate change, roads and bridges are a mess. They're dangerous. So if he started with that.
Yeah, well, we definitely we don't want bridges falling down. But you don't want more. It's not just maintenance. It's, you know, adding lanes on freeways. You don't want highway expansion in this era when we have to drive down carbon emissions. But I think Biden knows exactly what he's doing. He's going to sell this locally. He's designated three of his cabinet members, Jennifer Granholm at Department of Energy, the former governor of Rhode Island, what's her name, Alan Rimaldo, is now the head of Department of Commerce. And then the labor secretary, the former mayor of Boston.
Yes.
So they're out there. This is like, you know, new cabinet Jeopardy for me. They are out there selling this, and it's money for local communities. It's going to be hard, you know, there's the Republican Party and then there's reality. And if you're a Republican mayor or a Republican governor, like Baker in Massachusetts, and a cabinet member shows up and says, if this infrastructure package passes, you're going to get blank $1 million for roads, bridges, solar farms, energy efficient schools, et cetera, et cetera. That is going to build enormous political pressure. It's hard to say no to money. So
The Republicans had no trouble saying no to free money for Medicaid expansion under the Trump era,
under the Obama era.
Yeah, but
that was free money, no nothing.
True. That is a very good point. But this is standing with a mayor saying, we want this. You know who's the biggest advocate for wind energy in the Senate? Grassley from Iowa, because Iowa and Texas has more wind than any other state. And they're going to see that those benefits.
So let's see if Grassley votes with the Democrats or the Republicans. You know, I mean, you're right. That has been his position. But in the end, they're all scared to death of Trump.
This is where I'm
in agreement with Judith, because I think Biden is attempting to redefine what bipartisan is. We've seen him do this with the last major bill that they just passed, which was the COVID relief bill. The redefinition of bipartisan is a Democratic president and a Republican governor or a Republican mayor, because I do believe that by taking his message, as Judith just stated, locally and drawing up support locally, I think that's how he gets the bill passed. I mean, how is Mr. Grassley going to say no, or anyone else going to say no, when the majority of their governors who are all
Grassley
looking for that financial...
Hold on, one at a time. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry.
No, go ahead, Rosemary, and then Alan.
I this is what Alan calls should have versus what will really happen. Grassley will say no.
Should have, could have, would have.
Same way that he said no. Yeah. just in the same way that Grassley said no to oversight. He was the author of bills on oversight over government, and yet he let Trump run roughshod over that. He let him fire people, coerce people, and he stood by and let it happen. Grassley is, I think, senile. He's got some problems mentally, and I do not think
but
that he is
that,
more loyal to
guy.
The country than to the party. Yeah, other than that, he's fine.
We have no diagnosis on that, but just saying. Go ahead, Alan.
There is that. Hey, look, here's what happened. As Monk would have said, here's what really happened.
I love that show. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. What really happened is that Biden put in everything but the kitchen sink in this thing. And then he announced, day one, I'm willing to compromise. He has some extra stuff in there. He's willing to get rid of it. And it was smart to do it that way. But you know what? I have a feeling that the orange menace will not allow it. He simply will say, you get a primary if you may do anything to help this guy get a program passed.
Yeah, but he is not who he used to be, okay? Yes, he's on Fox all the time.
Yep.
He's not on Twitter. You have Biden and his cabinet members lining up mayors, governors, unions, chambers of commerce for investments like clean drinking water, upgrading sewage treatment plants. I think they can take on the orange menace. I think they win when they make this local. And I think that's precisely why Biden went big. He's not going to get exactly what he wanted, but he will get much more than just roads and bridges. I mean, you've got, you know, really serious problems with drinking water in lots of Republican districts. And so I am fairly confident that the smart people in the White House are working 7 days a week, cranking out spreadsheets, saying, here's what this infrastructure package means in Congressional District 19. More importantly, you know, Congressional District 7 in Florida and Congressional District 10 in Wisconsin. They're going to sell this locally and they're going to prevail.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about other stories. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, David Soares, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have a ton of letters, but none of them are on the climate. They all are about this subject, which is right here in Albany. 8 days after protesters and city police officers clashed at the entrance of South Station, Mayor Kathy Sheehan and Police Chief Eric Hawkins, ordered dozens of officers Thursday afternoon to forcibly clear a small encampment that demonstrators had set up outside the police station. Officers were seen throwing a resistant protester to the ground and zip-tying his hands behind his back, as well as another using a baton to bash camping chairs. Some police were seen with tape placed to obscure their badge numbers. About 2 hours after the confrontation, a protester was seen being put into an ambulance. The severity or nature of the injuries was unclear Thursday evening. Demonstrators were chanting Black Lives Matter in the intersection as their former camp was cleared. Police say they arrested 8 people at the South Station on charges including disorderly conduct, obstruction of government administration, and rioting. 5 received appearance tickets for city court. The others were sent to Albany County Jail. Police said some of the charges were related to the April 14th incident between police and protesters. So back to the letters that we have been getting, and I'll just go through some of these so we can include them in the comments from the panel. One of them is, why did the Albany police dressed in riot gear cover their badge numbers with duct tape before forcibly removing protesters? How blind are police and civic leaders to this blatant attempt to hide from accountability? This one from Rick. Please explain why the Albany police decided to break up a lawful and peaceful protest yesterday. I'm a practicing lawyer and don't recall that there is a statute of limitations in the First Amendment. And we go to Luke. Alan is right. This regarding your comments at 7:45, Alan. As an Albany resident, I'm terribly disappointed with Chief Hawkins and Mayor Sheehan. On the 14th of April, tensions rose during a demonstration only after an officer shoved a bullhorn into a demonstrator's face, badly splitting her lip on her teeth. Byron,
I'll tell you how old I am. I'm so old I don't remember saying it.
Well, you're getting credit, so. But that's good.
Take the credit.
Yeah, right. Finally, this one from Byron. Finally, meaning we have many more, but I'm just going to end here because I want to get to the issue. Byron says, Albany mayor and Albany police chief, they don't know what they're doing. They should both resign. If you can't reach out to the community and have to use force against protesters from the community instead of meeting with community and listening to what their grievances are, they might learn something. So, Alan, let's start with you, and then I'll go to David on this.
Well, you know, obviously, and David, by the way, has proven himself a great champion of allowing people to peacefully protest. And he's the district attorney. Now, I remember very well, I had a little bit to do with it, when the governor decided that some of the Sunni people who were protesting on the lawn out there should be arrested for protesting on the lawn. And David said, no, I'm not going to do that. So those in authority are always trying to stop what they consider to be inconvenient behavior. But, hey, I wouldn't want to be mayor. I wouldn't want to be governor. These are tough jobs, and I certainly wouldn't want to be the police chief.
How about district attorney? David, do you want to be district attorney still? Is that all right?
Well, first of all, I'll start off by saying that there are things I'm not going to, I can't comment.
I know, I realize that.
I'm involved here. But I will say this to the public, okay? Deep breaths, okay? Take very, very, very deep breaths. And also take the time to delve in and get as much information and be as informed as possible before reaching conclusions. You see, I mean, I could offer, I'm on this show to offer an opinion, and then I can do that, but I also have the burden of proof, okay? Which means that I have to make sure that I do my due diligence in getting as much information about what's transpiring in our local community before rendering a decision. And I would encourage the public to get as much information as possible. Don't read one story. Don't watch, you know, whatever version of the 30 seconds is coming from videos on social media. But there's a lot happening in our community, not only locally. There's a lot happening nationally, and I just think that, you know, we need to really take a step, take a deep breath, and figure out how we're going to negotiate our path forward towards achieving the goals of redefining what it means to have, law enforcement in your community, that clashes are not the way to bring about change. Clashes are the way to bring about frustration. As far as on the subject, the only thing I can say is do your due diligence and explore and understand the issues before arriving at conclusions that I'm, you know, hearing in terms of the letters that are being generated.
Let's go to Rosemary, your thoughts on this?
Albany has had trouble between the black community and its police since the 70s. It was one of the first stories that the papers were working on when I first got out of college. And I can't believe that we are still here. And everything David said is absolutely right, except the problem is there already is a clash. There's a situation right now. So the time for deep breaths and pensive thinking are long past. I don't think it's being handled correctly right now. I think it did heighten the trouble. I'm very bothered by the fact that not just in Albany, but across the nation, there are laws being considered or passed that reduce the right to protest. We have driven people to the point where protest and violence, in some cases, is the only measure they have. And now we're trying to take that away. It's insane. The time is now to sit down with both sides and say, what are your real demands? What can we do right now today to ease this? And I'm sorry, I'm not seeing that happen. I'm disappointed in the administration in Albany. This is an opportunity.
Rosemary, can I just interrupt you for one second? Rosemary, can I just interrupt you for one second? And I'm going to do this at the risk of my own safety here with you. I'm very much afraid of you, and I admit that. What you're saying is correct to the extent that when you're looking and talking about negotiations, okay, well, you have to figure out, well, what are the terms of the negotiations? And when you start out by, okay, you must disarm yourself, that's unrealistic. When you start out with, okay, well, we're not leaving until someone's fired, well, there are processes for that, right? That's not realistic. And the other thing, too, is, look, we've seen protests in the Capital District since the beginning of time. It's what we do here, right? And the thing is, you can never, like, I'm never going to be a person who's going to stand by and watch people's right to express their First Amendment rights ever be trampled upon by law enforcement. And we have a history of that. Year after year after year, we see people being arrested. And the considerations that go into the decisions as to whether or not to prosecute or not prosecute is, was there a destruction of property? Was there injuries to others, right? I mean, those are the primary ones, right? But I don't know to what sense it makes. And I'm just giving you, you know, now the opinion. And I'm not talking specifically about the issues that have transpired over the course of the last 72 hours. But we've had protests here dating back years where we want to tax the rich, right? And those protests usually take form in people, at the Capitol or, you know, in parks or what have you. Well, now they've been taken to the streets where we see highways being blocked, right? Where we see roadways being blocked. And you know something? Those highways and roadways, those protests aren't inconveniencing the rich, right? It's protests against the rich, but they're inconveniencing the poor. And it always happens at times when parents are leaving work to go pick up their children, or we have emergency response vehicles that need the thoroughways in order to get to and from the hospitals. And so it's like, yes, we protect people's rights to express themselves, right? But we also have to balance those individual rights, right, with the rights of the greater community and the need for, you know, for example, access to roadways.
So, David, what you're saying to people who are completely frustrated and have waited decades is you can protest, but it has to be convenient in a place and time of our choosing, and we'll license it so it doesn't inconvenience other people. And, that will really
ridiculous.
Make a difference.
That's ridiculous.
That's so frustrating.
But what you just said is so ridiculous.
Hold on.
But here's the thing about the Constitution, Rosemary, okay? Every single one of those Bill of Rights, and I think you know that, every single one, they're not limitless, right? Government does have the right to tailor and contour the contours of how that expression is exhibited, all right? Because without it, then you can just go about doing anything. And you know, you've been covering this and you've been doing this for your entire career. That this isn't about, I'm not suggesting that, oh, listen, I'm comfortable with what you do in expressing your rights so long as you're not kneeling at football games. That's absurd. I stand for and will do everything in my power to always protect an individual's right to protest. But that is not limitless.
I don't think we disagree. I mean, for the sake of an argument, we're making it sound like a disagreement. I'm not even expressing support of doing that. I am expressing an understanding of why these protests have become increasingly more confrontational and violent. There is huge frustration because no one in government seems to be listening. And that heightened under the Trump years, no question about it. And again, go back to now we want to limit protests, that if you hurt somebody in a protest, you can't be criminally liable. We just are hemming in people. We're not really talking with them. So I'm not advocating for it. Don't get me wrong, but I do understand. I sound like Chris Rock.
Well, there are different levels of political protest. Most that take place in Albany, the protest organizers actually apply for a permit. and it is somewhat orchestrated, and police in uniform show up and watch you. That's not what this was. I think this was an almost spontaneous reaction to a situation, social situations that are boiling over because people are really upset and frustrated with what they see going on in their communities and also nationwide. You know, this is part of a national situation that is unfolding before us in Albany. David is correct. There are some pretty practical concerns here. When I saw Chief Hawkins interviewed yesterday, he said that, you know, there are people living on the street where the street was closed down. This was an encampment that propped up. There are, you know, issues associated with that. What I found unusual is every night when I was watching the coverage this on the news, I kept turning to Mark and saying, they need to get a mediator in there. And maybe they did. But this was like classic mediation situation where you have a trusted third party talking to the people in the encampment, going back to that police station that had to keep functioning during all of this. I did notice that yesterday at the 11th hour, they invited Dr. Alice Green into the conversation. They should have done that days ago. And she was on camera criticizing the police for giving the people who were making a political statement 15 minutes to clear out. So every night, this looked like this was escalating. And, you know, David's right. We don't know everything that went on. It doesn't look like there was a serious attempt at mediation. And then the police lose so much credibility when they take white tape and cover their badge numbers. There's photographs of that. So that's something that the police need to explain to the community, why that happened and how are they going to be held accountable for doing that. But my final point is, this morning, Mayor Sheehan and Chief Hawkins need to do a news conference and answer every single question that they can legally about what unfolded, what could have been handled differently, and then most importantly, what are they going to do to address the systemic issues that people felt so compelled to camp out on city streets for days over. I mean, there's always kind of the drama of the moment, and I'm not diminishing it. It looked quite bad on film, but we have to get to the systemic issues of police relations with the community and what brought people out for the last few days.
Alan, anything you want to say before we go to break?
Yeah. There's so much that is involved in all of this that is not only of the moment, but before. In other words, how police are recruited, who gets a chance to be a policeman, do we have a supplementation of police by social workers and others who can diffuse situations. So, I think it's appropriate to look at what the police have done in a specific moment, but I think it's also very important that we understand how this is really going to change.
We'll pause there. We'll take a break when we come back. We have a lot of letters on this, and we'll continue with those, and we'll move on to other subjects as well. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Judith Henk, and David Soares. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. First, we'll take a break, and then news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our second hour this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Judith Henk, and David Soares. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot of them. Chris writes, please tell me one instance where one of the Trump caravans blocking roads and bridges were dispersed forcibly. Two, Herb writes, I've seen on numerous occasions police officers with their shield numbers intentionally hidden. These are clearly officers whose intentions will not stand the light of day. There should be state law that makes the intentional obscuring of one's shield number a crime, at least a misdemeanor. question for David, and knowing I'll read this, and David can tell me what he can talk about and what he can't. We don't want to get him in trouble. Mark says, is it legal in New York State to record police interactions that you witness? Can the police confiscate your phone to prevent you from taping? Does it make any difference if you're taping the police in a public space as opposed to private property like a Walmart parking lot?
No. As a matter of fact, there's a new law that creates a civil cause of action against government if you're interrupted from filming, so long as that filming takes place not within the orbit of what the engagement is. For example, if someone's placing another person, you know, under arrest, you're not permitted to go into that field of interaction and film, but you can from safe distance be able to do that. And if that is interfered with now, that is a civil cause of action. So I think your Senate, your legislative body, along with the governor, just took care of that issue.
Imagine if the George Floyd incident was not recorded by the 19-year-old woman, because the initial police report was nothing close to what actually transpired. And this woman very bravely stood there recording that incident. And I think that's one reason the trial decision went the way it did.
Yeah, Danielle Frazier, and she actually was 17. She was a girl, not a woman. So it was super brave that she did it. In fact, there was some talk of her getting a Pulitzer Prize. She did a great act of journalism while just simply being a little girl, basically, a teenager. Mm. So, yeah, that's true. I actually think that more than police reform and meetings and discussions, if you just gave a whole bunch of people cameras and let them follow around police, we might be better off.
Mm,
well,
so.
On that note, you know, part of the reason why, you know, I made my earlier comments about taking a deep breath and waiting for all of the information to come through, because I can't tell you how many times throughout an investigation where, you know, you may arrive at a conclusion watching something or hearing something. And then when you do a thorough investigation and you are able to review the abundance of data, you find yourself at a different place. That's what I'm talking about here. The 30-second clip from someone's phone without an analysis of everything else is just simply not enough for individuals to arrive at certain conclusions. And so that's part of the reason I said what I said.
I think, David, you're the DA and you have to say that, but this is a story that unfolded over a couple days and people know the context and we know what we saw. We don't know what was happening behind the scenes, but you know, this is not a good situation. This was not handled well by the police. It also did not lift up nonviolent protest, which I am deeply committed to. So, you know, there are a lot of issues here, but it's really important for the police and the mayor to take some responsibility. They can describe their side of the story, but they need to explain why it unfolded this way. And I think it would go a long way to handle some of the simple parts of this, which is if they've got photographic evidence of police covering up their badges, that will be addressed. And why do we have a situation where police feel like they have to do it and they do it? But I don't know. I think now there's attention focused on this. This is a big issue. Rosemary's right. This didn't, you know, happen overnight. And I just think this is a bit of a crisis, and you want to use that to talk about long-term systemic change and how a situation like this could have been handled differently, but both from the people who were there expressing their views and by the you know, the power of the state in the form of the police.
Go ahead, David.
I think they will do that. I think you should hear from law enforcement at some point in time today explaining, mm-hmm. you know, their conduct. I don't think there's any disagreement there that there is that obligation. I think when you are, you know, government and you are in law enforcement, that you should always be prepared to explain your actions. And there's no disagreement there.
There are moments when you hear somebody say something and you just wince, and I'm finding myself doing that much more in my life, by the way. But when the mayor Sheehan spoke out and compared the event to the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, I was like, ooh, and I don't.
And then she walked it back.
She walked it back,
right?
And she
I had the same reaction.
She apologized, but I. And it is important to say that she apologized. But the initial thought, I mean, those are two very different things, at least mm-hmm. in my mind. Any thought on that, Rosemary? Go ahead, David.
As a citizen, when I'm observing things that are happening in our country, look, I get it, you know. The shootings that are taking place, these events, and the lethality that African Americans and people of color seem to experience for what should be sort of routine interactions. I mean, vehicle and traffic interactions, right? That is an issue. That is an issue, and it's a significant issue. And I think it's always been an issue, right? Except we've never had the validation of video. Right. To demonstrate these things are, in fact, taking place and we weren't just talking about it. Right. But I'm also very cautious not to allow for things that are happening elsewhere I make distinctions between what's happening here because I've got to deal with it as to what's happening elsewhere. Now, people right. tend to assign those similarities and say, OK, well, it's the same. But it's not the same thing. An insurrection. A planned insurrection to overtake our government can never be compared to anything other than what someone named Jefferson Davis attempted to do at one time in our country. And you can't draw similarities between those events. The events that took place here a week ago are terrible, and they will be dealt with locally. What we need to do is have, you know, dialogue. You also have to have a destination, right? Where do you want to get to? And then begin that dialogue and negotiate as to how we get to that destination. And I don't see that being done.
I understand everything you're saying. I just want to ask about one part of it because, you know, this should be dealt with on its, on its own set of circumstances, but it's impossible, isn't it, David, to not, I'm not saying compare it to what happened. I don't mean to defend that action. I certainly don't. But what is happening more broadly across the country, it's impossible not to add this to the list of things that have happened when it comes to protests and police and use of force.
What you're asking me is it possible not to compare?
I'm just saying you were talking about it's important. You were making the point that and I agree with the point. The point is that, you know, we have to take care of this in the city and locally. We have to take care of this, but it is impossible, is it not, to look at what's happening of those of us who look at everything and the macro. And put this into, yes, it's playing out in our backyard, but to put it into a context of what's playing out across the country.
Oh, I there's no disagreement there. There's no disagreement there. What I'm saying is that, yes, there's a big problem, right? You know, for example, there's a health problem right now in our country, right? But when you go to the doctor, it's a diagnosis of what's happening with you.
Right.
Right. And you're treating it that way. But you're not
in treating that individual issue, you're not turning a blind eye to what's happening all across the country. I happen to think that a community like Albany can, in fact, you know, be a leader in fixing a lot of the issues that we're seeing right now all throughout the country. I believe that we have the dynamics that are physically present here to really bring about, you know, significant change. We will lose those opportunities as time goes on and as these conflicts, you know, escalate. I believe that. But again, I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can deal with the violence that we see happening in our streets every single day, and at the same time, redefine what it means to enforce laws in the Capital District. I'm confident of that.
Rosemary?
Boy, I'm sitting here listening to all of this, and I agree with that. We have a huge problem. It is not just in Albany. It is not unique to Albany, although, of course, how can you argue that there are unique characteristics to Albany's problems compared to elsewhere? But I don't know what the answer is. I keep wondering why did they move out that encampment today? What is the thinking of officials who bring on problems? Why did they cover their badges? Why aren't there charges against them? Why aren't we investigating? I'm sorry. I'm much more on this. I think I'm much more on the side of the protesters. We've waited a long time. People have been patient. They have watched death and injury and ignoring of their problems. And it's not at all surprising that there's this outburst of rage. Is that so terrible? And I don't want to be unconstitutional and yeah, obey the laws and property damage is bad, blah, blah, blah. But we have to listen to our fellow citizens.
Alan?
Well, I'm with Rosemary. I've been listening to this, and, you know, I think people have a right to peaceful protest, and they should. I don't like the fact that officers are covering up their badge numbers, because obviously that's why they're there. They're on their badges so that people can identify them
right.
And complain about them if they have to, and that doesn't make an awful lot of sense. I've been an admirer of David Soares. I've said so. He's a chief basically law enforcement guy in Albany because he has insisted that people have a right to peacefully protest. And let's face it, folks, DAs have to get along with the police because the police can make it very hard for the DA or they can make it much easier. They can testify when called upon and all the rest. So, you know, it's multifactorial, no question about it. It is not an easy thing. But I'm with Rosemary when she says that, you know, she's basically with the right of people to protest.
Gary writes to us and says, I was president at Occupy Albany and found the police behavior there quite different. While the current incident is different in all details, the significant factors are that it was about police behavior and primarily of black people. That is the ugly situation still not resolved. What do you make of that comment, David?
I think the people that are drawing comparisons between and this is what I mean, right? When you see, I get how people can draw comparisons, but then you have to arrive at and be a little more critical in your thinking when you are making these comparisons. One event took place in a public park that provided no encumbrances to individuals going free and roaming about the community. The other event took place in the middle of a road, okay? If anyone who has any kind of institutional history will remember how Occupy Albany was eventually brought to an end, you should go back and look that up because I remember tear gas and I remember horses and I remember it not being such a peaceful ending. So I don't know that there was any difference in how both events were brought to an end. And if you can find video footage of those events, I will stand corrected if someone can tell me that there was a difference in how those events were brought to an end.
Gordon writes to us and says the difference between a protest rally and civil disobedience legally, the Albany street occupation strikes me as civil disobedience, where the expectation of intervention by the authorities and arrest had to be greater than zero among the participants. Back in the days of the Vietnam War, civil disobedience actions were preceded by detailed training on how to get arrested. I don't see how the protesters can complain about being arrested when that was an inevitable outcome of their occupation of the street.
I don't think they were complaining about being arrested. I think they were complaining about how they were physically handled and how their tents and personal equipment was, you know, pulled apart. This was an act of civil disobedience, which you usually have some pretty extensive training with. But I share Rosemary's question. Yeah, it was the middle of the street. It wasn't Central Avenue. It's not a main thoroughfare. I mean, wouldn't smarter heads prevail? And unless there was like major disruption, let people stay. It did not look like it was growing. It looked like it started spontaneously. And it's not like this was a dramatic split second decision. This was unfolding over a couple days. So this seems to be, it was a purposeful strategy to show up and say, you've got 15 minutes to clear out. And if you don't, you're going to be arrested. That's one thing. But this was a whole lot more than threatening arrest. I think it could have been handled much, much better. And I go back to my point of they had a couple days, they could have pulled in some faith leaders, some respected voices on both sides, and actually had a conversation, not just about the logistics of the occupation, but also what, you know, the demands of the people who spent days protesting, perhaps unrealistic. Their demand was the resignation of the police chief and the mayor. So you listen to them, you ask them why they made those demands, and then you work backwards from there. And let them hear why that's not likely going to happen, but here are some things that could happen. I mean, this was also happening in the context of, wasn't there a bill in the Albany City Council about the use of tear gas?
About tear gas, right.
So I think that also was part of the mix here. And look, I have tremendous respect.
Just so you know, there was no use of tear gas.
Yeah.
No.
Good. I know. I appreciate that.
Although it was initially, just to clarify, though, but it was initially reported by some news outlets that there was tear gas used. And I don't even know news outlets.
Because there were fires. There were fires in the middle of the road for the encampment.
So,
and that's where they lose me, on the burn barrels. Very polluting. But you're, yes, David, there was not the use of tear gas, but that has been a debate in the city of Albany.
The Common Council tabled the bill to ban tear gas
two days
ago. Right.
So who reported? So who reported that tear gas was used? Does anybody know?
I had it here a minute ago. Somebody that was a part of it was tweeting it out, and there had been a report within the group that tear gas was used, but upon bond investigation, it was not.
It was an illegal burn barrel that looked like tear gas, but it wasn't tear gas.
Yep. Okay. We have to take a break, and I'm looking to see when I have to be out here. We have to take a break. So we'll do that, and when we come back, we'll finish up the show today. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Judith Enk, and David Soares. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. Last call for all of it. We'll have our last go-around with our group this morning. We always welcome you. panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Forever is going to start tonight, just so you know. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our last call. We have a wonderful panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Judith Enk, and David Soares. We have about 10 minutes together, and I want to just end, I think, on this issue, because I will tell you, I've been totally geeking out over this story, and I don't really know. I'm still trying to find as much information as I can about it, but I'm fascinated by it. I was born in the city of Washington, D.C., so the fact that the House approved D.C. statehood yesterday is fascinating to me. Obviously, there are Senate obstacles that remain, but the House voted along party lines to grant statehood to Washington, D.C. as Democrats move to use their congressional majority to accomplish a long-held goal that has become a central plank in the party's push to expand voting rights and address racial inequity. The legislation would establish a 51st state called Washington Douglas Commonwealth in honor of Frederick Douglass, the Black emancipation and civil rights leader, while leaving the National Mall, Capitol Hill, and the White House, as well as some other federal property under congressional control. The new state would have a single voting representative in the House and two senators representing its more than 700,000 residents, most of whom are people of color. Rosemary, what do you make of this?
Wow, it's another one of these issues long overdue, should have been solved long before. It will not be solved in the next 2 years. There are just simply not the votes, and it isn't going to happen, and I hate that. It's something that I think is going to have to be put off at least for 2 years. But there's some other things that could happen right away. One is, why is it a no voting member of Congress representing D.C. right now? Why doesn't Elizabeth Norton, is that her first name? Why doesn't Eleanor. She have an actual Eleanor. Vote? Yep. Eleanor, that's it, Eleanor. Why doesn't she have a vote? That could happen right away. And the other thing I don't understand, maybe you all can enlighten me, is why exactly both Washingtonians and Marylanders are reluctant to have the district outside of the Capitol itself, which indeed the Constitution does set aside as separate from a
right.
state. Why are they unwilling to make that change? Why isn't it part of Maryland?
And that's
why
one of the things.
Why could it not be?
Right. I don't get that.
I don't get that at all. But if you want to talk about unconstitutional, go ahead. I just want to say 700,000 people without a vote is absolutely unconstitutional.
Alan?
Well, how about 5 million without a vote in Puerto Rico?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, you're right. That's another good. I was going to bring that up too. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the problem, of course, Rosemary, on that one is if you fold them in with Maryland, you don't get the two senators. And those two senators, as we see,
isn't that really what the sticky point is here?
What did you say, David? What is?
I said that's really the sticky point here, and the reason why we won't see this bill move into actual law is because of the imbalance of the Senate, and they don't want an additional two senators there, especially the Republicans. You know, and I think that the other issue to consider here is that there's actually a larger population in Washington, D.C. than there is in the state of Vermont, and I think the other only state is Wyoming with less of a population there, but both represented in the Senate with votes.
Right. Hey, don't take Vermont representation away. I think the reality is the Republicans will fight this to the death, because in the last presidential election, 95% of the residents of the District of Columbia voted for Biden. It's a Democratic stronghold, sure, except for the lobbyists in Georgetown. So, you know, the Republicans will fight this with every breath they have. They don't want more representation. This is a real issue. You know, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands has a similar setup. They have a delegate who serves on there. It's not called a delegate. It's called representative or something. I'm forgetting the official name. They serve on committees, but they don't vote on the floor. And I can tell you, as someone who tried to get more financial support to Puerto Rico and issue support to Puerto Rico when I served at EPA, Puerto Rico was at a dramatic disadvantage not having two senators and a House member who is voting. So this also applies to territories.
Alan, probably give you the last word here. I got about 2 minutes.
Well, it needs to be done. And the last time they did it, they traded Alaska and Hawaii. Each side got another two senators. So I couldn't agree more, I think it was with Judith, that it ain't going to get done.
Yeah. Is Rosemary, I was struck, and again, we're against time here, but I was struck by what you said too about, you know, so you put it off for, you say you don't do this in 2 years, but you know, if not now, when, I guess, is the question.
The minute that Democrats either get rid of the filibuster or have the votes to do it, because this is not going to be a bipartisan vote.
No,
that's for sure.
And what votes are missing? And they don't have enough votes in the House on their own, obviously. So what votes they would need? They would need at least, what, one Republican?
You mean in the Senate?
Correct.
You said the House.
Yeah, I apologize. Yeah. Yes, that's what I meant.
No, right now in the Senate, they need 10 votes. And they're never going to get that. Never.
Mm. And they're probably not even going to get one Republican because they think it's the balance of power in the Senate.
Well,
and as for Puerto Rico, yes, they deserve representation, too. That is not going to be done at the same time. The Democrats would be crazy to try to push that through. That really does look like they're trying to stack the deck, sort of like the Republicans squelching the vote and stacking the Supreme Court. Democrats would be doing the same in the legislative branch.
And what's different with Puerto Rico is not everyone in Puerto Rico supports statehood, whereas in D.C., the large, large majority of the residents do want statehood.
Good point.
All right. We're going to call it there. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. Alan Chartok, thank you very much, as always. Have a great weekend.
You too, Joe.
David, Judith, Rosemary, enjoy the weekend. Thank you for being with us. Great to have you all here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, bye-bye. We'll be back with more Roundtable right after this.